I'm Jeff Timmer. I've advised Republican candidates at the local, state, and national level as a consultant and as executive director of the Michigan GOP. Now I'm a political nomad who's put what's best for the country above carrying water for my former political party.
And I'm Mark Brewer. For 18 years, I battled Jeff and his Republican allies as chair of the Michigan Democratic Party. These days, I'm a lawyer and consultant to progressive nonprofits, political parties, candidates, and ballot question committees.
This is a republic if you can keep it. Inside the backrooms of Michigan politics with veteran political strategists Jeff Timmer and Mark Brewer.
Joining the conversation this week is longtime Democratic polling guru Stan Greenberg. Stan is a New York Times best-selling author and polling advisor to presidents, prime ministers, and CEOs globally. And right now, he's conducting deep research in multiple countries. He was the senior pollster for President Bill Clinton and Vice President Al Gore, British Prime Minister Tony Blair, and South African President Nelson Mandela. His corporate clients have included Microsoft and other global companies.
Greenberg's research and writing on disruptive changes in the U.S., Britain, Europe, South Africa, and Venezuela, and on the parties of both left and right is driving the public debate. His book about how America addresses its deepest problems was applauded by Walter Isaacson, author of Steve Jobs, for its great sense of history, as well as deep understanding of the hopes and fears of today's Americans. And his new book, RIP GOP, was published by St. Martin's Press in the fall of 2019.
I first met Stan when he came to Macomb County back in the 1980s, and it's great to be talking to him again.
That's where I learned anything that mattered was there. It is like deep in my consciousness at each point, and also the good souls that I work with, a lot of people with good values, who tried to make the political process work. So I have a lot of respect for the people that I work with, going right through to David Bonnier and others.
That's an interesting place to do politics. I did my first campaigns, cut my political teeth in Macomb County, usually doing battle with Mark and his clients.
Well, you're kind of doing a little bit better these days, right?
And well, the Republicans have made some gains, and it's interesting. As you coined the term way back when the Reagan Democrats, how there's a place like Macomb County, now three decades later, has continued to be looked at as a bellwether. But that's an interesting point of conversation, is it?
Yep.
Is it in fact indicative of where, is Oakland County or Kent County here in Michigan, or, those kinds of higher income suburban counties around the country, are they becoming more of a battleground for the Biden Republicans, if mm-hmm. that's the term? And I know that that's also something that you've written about recently.
Well, what I've learned is you have to do both. That you cannot choose. And while, there has been a trend, toward a more diverse country, multicultural country, growth of more affluent and college graduates, particularly with millennials, are better educated than other generations, all of which have kind of edged up the education scale. But what I think we didn't factor in was Trump's ability to animate and increase engagement and turnout and bring in new voters. In response to those very trends. Those trends were, the threat they focused on, the demographic problem. And I think I underestimated his ability to change the electorate and make them continue as a factor, despite the, slow decline in their proportion of the electorate. He's actually increased their proportion of the voters by increased turnout. And that's required more and more animated and ugly campaign, in my view. But nonetheless, it's a fact of life now that we have to consider both kind of the persuasion battle over kind of the Reagan Democrats, but also the battle for who gets involved, who's engaged.
Stan, those new voters that Trump pulled out that you just talked about in the last presidential election. Will they come out, you think, without Trump at the top of the ticket? Will they come out for a Trump-like candidate running for governor next year, for example?
I don't know. I'm a little skeptical that they come out, you know, in Michigan. I mean, it may be a little bit different in Georgia, you know, where, you know, he's like, you know, fought this battle, you know, of a lifetime where the election was, you know, was stolen from him. Michigan was part of the mix, you know, but it wasn't, you know, and obviously focused, on Detroit, but the battle to the end, was in Arizona and, because it was Republican officials he was fighting with who were keeping him from, you know, getting the, being reelected as, you know, as president. I really have no idea. And I think we have to be, you know, careful on what will bring turnout, what impacts turnout in the midterms. I mean, traditionally, you would have reaction against an incumbent president, and you would expect them then to have higher turnout, reacting against Biden. I mean, that would be the normal thing. And particularly since they're also saying, you know, this is cancel culture and a whole, you know, whole triumph of, you know, radicalism and socialism. And you have to, you know, you have to turn out. And so I think we have to watch the registration. Yeah. Because I think we'll know in real time whether people are, registering to vote, and see which party is registering people, you know, to vote. On the other hand, you know, if you looked at this last election, I mean, he controlled the whole federal government. He used the National Guard. He focused every second on the unrest in cities and, you know, made the case, you know, the Democratic governance was, you know, was violence, growing crime, defund the police. You know, he constantly fueled, racial conflict. You know, can he do that from outside? Where he doesn't, you know, where he doesn't control the government, control the spotlight, you know, in the same way. I'm sure they're looking at immigration right now, what's happening on the border. And but again, does he have the same ability the way he did in this last election? It's been a year. I mean, if you think about, you know, the whole pandemic and, you know, focused on what was happening to the police and crime and, you know, all of that, you know, was extraordinary power, you know, brought out a lot of voters in. And, you know, can that happen from outside the White House? Can he, if he's not on the ballot? I mean, can he shape the electorate, you know, in the same way? So my gut tells me that he can't. And it'll also be tied up with, you know, lots of, you know, other things, you know, from criminal prosecutions, from, you know, a whole range of things, finances, whole range of things that will distract him, you know, from this. And so I think, you know, jury's out, but there's lots of factors coming to play.
Stan, you mentioned defund the police. Do you think that has continuing appeal as a campaign message? Are we going to see that resurrected in 2022?
Look, everything depends on President Biden. And, you know, he was against defunding the police, as, you know, as were virtually every Democrat, you know, in the country. But I think it's different when you have Joe Biden as president and he's saying, I'm funding the police, you know, because in fact he's putting the state money in. You're going to see, you know, budgets. I think that's going to be diffused by just what's happening, you know, in terms of the country. They can be focused on other things, you know, beyond that. I mean, they'll try to do that, but right now they're on cancel culture rather than the police. Is the kind of the focus. I mean, there'll be some piece of it, you know, that they'll focus. Probably immigration, you know, is the thing that they have focused on, you know, the most, and obviously impacted things, you know, in Michigan, you know, over a number of years. But harder when you're not the president. Harder when there's another president who has more control over what the agenda is, you know. And I think you're looking at, you know, people, you know, getting a lot of help that they've been desperate to receive. And I think they're going to be really grateful for that. You're going into huge economic growth at the end of the year, double, you know, Trump's best, you know, quarter, very likely by the end of the year. With infrastructure, you're probably looking to, you know, the midterms with, you know, actual visible construction projects, you know, where jobs are being created.
Yeah, that's,
you know, maybe upward pressure on wages. So it's, to be honest, I'd rather have our hand.
Yeah.
Right now, you know, going into the midterm, even though I know the history, yeah, you know, I'd rather have our hand.
You seem to hit the nail on the head is where I was just going to go with this, is the rosy economic forecast with, you know, 8% or higher growth forecast as we head into 2022, with unemployment falling to near historic lows during 2022, is high as the Republicans dialed up the culture war in 2020 to deal with bad economic circumstance and bad performance during the pandemic. It seems like the only option they're going to have is to turn it up as high or higher in 2022 to counteract the good economic message that Biden and the Democrats are likely to be campaigning under in 2022. And so that just bodes for a as bad or worse campaign cycle in terms of the rhetoric and the division in 2022 than we, as we saw in the last election.
Yeah. And I combine that with Biden himself, who seems very, this is not somebody who would make the mistake of saying, you know, deplorables. I mean, he, you know, he listens to working people. He's very self-conscious about his working class roots. He, you know, he campaigns in these areas. He says he's listened to these voters. And if you look at what he's done in this first package, he's cut their taxes. He's provided, you know, a base of income for, you know, for children and, you know, and families. Taxes is also the other part of the, as you know, Republican playbook. The Democrats are going to raise your taxes. Well, they're going to cut your taxes. You know, them cutting the taxes on the unemployment benefits, which came under the bipartisan deals. You know, it's Democrats who cut, and those were big, visible tax, you know, increases that people really were surprised by. And Democrats look like they're being very tax sensitive. If you look at those tax cuts, and if you look at what's happening with the child tax credit.
Mark and Jeff will be back after a brief message.
Epic MRA is pleased to be a sponsor of this podcast. Epic MRA is a Lansing-based market research and public opinion polling firm with decades of experience measuring public opinion about politics, ballot proposals, federal, state, and local issues. Our clients include media outlets, school districts, colleges and universities, state agencies, and local governments across the state. When it comes to measuring voter opinions, Epic MRA has been known as the go-to Michigan pollster for over 25 years. Visit www.epicmra.com to learn more.
Well, Stan, you've written recently about what you call the Biden Republicans. We had Bill Kristol on a couple of weeks ago, and he started talking about red dogs, elected officials. Who might support? Who might support? But you're focused on the voters, these so-called Biden Republicans. So tell us about them, and you know, whether the Biden Republicans, do they stick with Democrats in 2022? What do you think?
Well, I mean, look, that's a trend that has, you know, carried forward for like decades. You know, more affluent voters, you know, have moved, you know, toward the Democrats. I mean, look at Michigan, look at Oakland County. And that was happening before. It was a growing trend. There was also more diversity, in those counties. It wasn't just affluent voters or college educated voters, but there was a trend in those, you know, affluent suburbs that was more and more, you know, Democratic. But what happened in the primaries, as you know, is you had, you know, Livingston, you had Republican counties suddenly have this surge of Democrats voting in the primary. For me, that was one of the bigger surprises, that I knew they were leaving, you know, Trump. I mean, he was driving them away. I mean, he's in control of the party. He's driving away moderates. He's driving away college-educated women, from the party. And what you've seen is a shift of all college voters, toward the Democrats. And they've acted, you know, they voted in the primary, which says to me that they're becoming Biden voters, and everything I'm seeing on him as president you know, would consolidate it. So I think it's real. I don't think it's, you know, obviously it has to be consolidated, but I also think he's alert to it. He's reinforcing historical trends, but it's also driven by dynamics within the Republican Party, which make it less and less, you know, hospitable, you know, to college educated, you know, voters, you know, who are voting for, you know, for Biden. The challenge for Biden, I mean, the opportunity is to deal both with the Biden Republicans, but also the Reagan Democrats and working class voters like in McComb that didn't yet come over. They were it was close in McComb. What was the number in McComb?
About a 30,000 vote margin for Trump, which was
not bad.
No, it was down 10. It was down 10,000. He won by 40 over Hillary, so it was a little narrower.
Yeah. But still needs to go further. I mean, and have a very different election. And the question though also is, what happens on turnout of those voters who came in for the first time to vote? And I describe them, these new voters. I mean, they are straight ticket voters. You know, he was calling these voters into the electorate to save the country from Democratic governance in places like Detroit, you know, with out of control crime. And obviously, that's not the situation, but I'm describing Trump's description of what happens when Democrats are, you know, are in control. And those new voters, you know, they voted straight Republican, whereas Biden was not doing that. Biden was actually saying, I'll work with both parties. He was making his case against Trump, not the Republican. And I think that created that dynamic where he had more ticket splitting with Biden voters, but no ticket splitting with Trump voters.
Yeah, the data we've seen on that stand so far here in Michigan indicates that. I've studied straight party voting for years. And it was stronger this time for the Republicans, as you indicated, that it's never been.
Right.
Might make you rethink getting, you know, those fights against getting rid of straight party voting, huh, Mark?
We'll keep it because it's important to our minority voters, particularly Jeff. Even though Michigan is one of the handful of states still that has it, most states have gotten rid of it principally by Republicans because they view it as something that helps Democrats by and large.
Yeah, I think Connecticut has it, which is where I'm from, where my wife has her district.
So, Stan, you talked about whether these Biden Republicans could be consolidated. What would be some signs of that? Did they vote down ballot for Democrats in 2020? If consolidation is occurring, will they start to do that? You indicated they participate in primaries. That's a good sign.
Yeah.
And they're more interested in the party. But how do we tell if they're consolidating going forward?
Well, I tell you what's different is that you now have the Republican Party having voted again in bloc against with no Republicans supporting this package, which is immensely popular before it's implemented. I think it'll be more popular once people are really getting money in their pocket that they need. You know, I'm in the middle of focus groups with Republicans. About halfway, you know, done with these groups, and I've been presenting the package to them, focus on things that affect, you know, that affect the working class. These Republicans, you know, when I ask why are they doing this, what I expected them to say, well, they blow up the deficit or campaign promises, you know, to win the election. They were like most of them, you know, said because, you know, they're just trying to help people because people are in desperate trouble after this year of this pandemic. And I think they're going to be seen as, you know, helping people. It is a very middle-class package, you know, as well, you know, every part of it, you know, goes up into the middle income, you know, range, the child tax credit, you know, is, you know, 150,000 or, you know, for married couples, but over, you know, over 100,000 for single. I mean, so it really is basically covering everybody getting these, new benefits, you know. So I think he has to deliver. I mean, there's a lot of stuff here. You know, can they deliver? You know, the first part of this is delivery, making sure people know about it. But, you know, if he's, you know, opening the schools, as they're doing and using the funds, you know, for that, you know, purpose. And if you look by, you know, into next year, he'll look like he's opened up the economy, opened up the schools, tax relief, and also real money for the middle class. It's a pretty good start.
Yeah, I mean, I know that my friends who are still helping Republican candidates are cautiously, the smart ones are cautiously dreading the good economic news they know is coming, because they know it's going to put them behind the eight ball heading into next year, that they're going to be fighting an uphill battle in that midterm election that they hope to have some tailwind. Instead, they're going to be, it's going to be blown in their face.
Yeah. I mean, look, Trump had such an advantage on who you trust to handle, manage the economy. Even when the polls showed, strong advantage for Biden, which was overstated, even within that, Trump had a huge advantage, double digit advantage at election day on who could handle the economy, and still actually has, good numbers. But I think that's going to, things are going to change if you've got, really rock and roll, good times. I think the mood of the country could really be very different. We've had 2/3 of the country saying we've been on the wrong track forever. I can't, think of a time where it's gotten, below 60 on wrong track. Let's see where things are at the end of the year.
What's your sense of where we are right now, Stan, based on what you're seeing and hearing out there? I mean, hope. Right. Mm-hmm. I think people are just, seeing kind of the end of the pandemic. It's they can visualize it. I think people are starting to feel a little better about the economy and so forth. I mean, do you have any sense of where we are right now in terms of voters and what their mood is?
Yeah. Look, I mean, I am doing focus groups and listening to people, and people are, starting to feel, a little bit more hopeful. But it's true what it's done. Also, it's hard to trust the polls, because I've been doing polls to try to examine what happened, last year, because so many of the polls, including my own, underestimated Trump and Trump's voters. And so I think there's a lot of work to be done on rethinking the polls. So I just did a poll where I have, changed the weighting to reflect things I learned in Europe. How we dealt with right-wing populists like Boris Johnson and the Brexit elections in Britain, or Netanyahu, and how he campaigned, late in the process, and in places like Austria, where the Haider and the Freedom Party, the neo-Nazis, surged, and how did you pull them, correctly? And so once I've done that, you have a very stable political climate for the moment. Now, this is before this package passed, before it's being implemented, but don't underestimate how polarized and stable the climate is going in. I think you have to make the assumption that, Trump's ability to bring, to bring his, right-wing populist bloc into the electorate is still there. In fact, those voters are real. and they avoid pollsters. Now, there are ways to deal with that, but it leads you to a more cautious view of where Biden is. We have his approval ratings about, 4 points lower than the average of the public polls in our poll. And Trump actually still has, 43% approving of what he's doing, close to what his past approval rating is. And so while I think things are changing, I think it's glacial. I think it's moving toward the Democrats because of all the things we're talking about. But it's the old land hasn't crashed, and we're entering into a new era. We're moving glacially, potentially, into a period where people may have a different mood.
That's interesting. We look at this so often. I mean, I think it's people say, oh, political realignment, that's thrown about too easily. And, you know, in order to have a true realignment, it does take, you know, some big events and some big movement.
Yep.
But we've definitely seen, I think, with the college educated whites moving so quickly away from the Republicans, we've seen at least the beginnings of what could turn into a long lasting, durable realignment. Mm-hmm. Socioeconomic more than racial.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's two. I think it's right. I think it's right. I think it's two pieces of it. One, that trend on the socioeconomic side, but the other is the divisions within the Republican Party. You know, I've been very surprised by the. If you looked at the polling at CPAC in terms of Trump standing amongst those voters. I think Trump was around 51%. If you also looked at the poll that was just done by Fabrizio amongst Republicans, and where Trump's at 51%, the incumbent, it was very popular. And, a very large portion, of the party, are with Trump, but they're not necessarily voting for him for president. And they're now voters who are going to vote for somebody else, not just in a primary. I mean, there are probably 10% of Republicans who will, potentially vote for a Biden or vote for a Democrat or stay home. Because the anti-Trump has become much more self-conscious and willing to express it now. And so you have a divided, Republican Party that has to play out. And so it's that process in conjunction with what's happening on the trend with more affluent voters and the Biden Republicans.
Well, let me kind of throw you a hypothetical, Stan. Suppose you were advising a Republican statewide candidate in Michigan next year. I know we're looking into the future. We're looking into the crystal ball. What kind of advice would you be giving them based on these divisions and the data you're seeing now?
Well, Do I have to win the nomination? Do I have to win my primary?
That's the paradox. Yes. You got to win a primary first in order to run November.
I've looked hard at the Republican Party, and you have we have 58% of Republicans who strongly approve of Trump. And we have 40%, who are not in that, but you really do have a 60% block that is strongly Trump, and what obviously needs signals that you're aligned with Trump. I don't see how you win if you run for those people. I don't see how you get yourself into a broader set of voters, to win statewide. And you're also, running against the popular, you should inform me otherwise, but pretty popular governor in the state. So I would I'd take my chances. That is, I would, I'd be brave and authentic and say, life is short. Who knows how this fight within the Republican Party is going to play out, but the future is not with Trump, even if you align with positions that Trump offered without, and say this is a different future than what Trump is offering without personally attacking Trump.
That's smart advice. I know the Republicans well, and that does not describe their mindset. They are averse to that kind of smart advice, positioning themselves opposite Trump. That was the only chance, for instance, that Bill Schuette really had against Whitmer 2 years ago when he first ran. But he ran so hard toward Trump in the primary that there was no chance for him to broaden his appeal in any real sense for November. And I think the Republicans are doomed to repeat that again because I don't think they can help themselves.
The dilemma that you described, Stan, may well explain why we have not seen any significant Republican candidate step forward and say they're going to run for governor.
Really?
You know what campaigns are like now, the money that has to be raised, the organizing that has to be done. And it's almost April and no candidate of any significance has stepped forward. I think they are on the horns of a dilemma.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we like their dilemma. It feels to me like you're comfortable with what things will look like in the midterms. Give me your sense of educate me about Michigan and Macomb.
Well, I am. But again, you know me, I don't take anything for granted. You know, events can turn, you can get surprises can get thrown at you. So I encourage all these candidates that we got redistricting coming up, which obviously is down ballot, but it's created a lot of uncertainty. So I just really encourage people to work their constituency and push forward these things. And I just, you know, I remember 1992 so well. It's the economy, stupid, right? These economic issues are so important, not just in Macomb, but elsewhere in the state. If people are feeling good, they got money in their pockets, and their prospects are looking good economically, that could be a big boost to us as Democrats next year. Jeff, what's your take?
Yeah, I mean, I really think the all the indicators right now are that I'd rather be Gretchen Whitmer than whoever it is, the Republicans. That being said, there is so much time for things to play out. For it's always the what don't you anticipate? What wrinkle is thrown in? I mean, assuming things stay relatively normal, you know, the pandemic ends as we're, you know, people get vaccinated, life returns back to normal next fall, kids go back to school and to college, and, you know, we're able to gather again and start to do normal life things. I think that kind of upends the political dynamic, the malaise that the incumbent White House party typically has in that midterm election. However, if there's any other external event that takes place, that could change the paradigm completely. You know, some kind of foreign disruption. You know, it's always that you know, the unanticipated crisis that tests the president, not the dealing with the expected. Mm-hmm.
Stan, I was fascinated a few moments ago. You mentioned your international work and how that has given you insight into voters who support right-wing authoritarian parties. Could you expand a little bit on that? What did you learn about those voters that you think translates into American politics?
Sure. First of all, across the Western democracies, you know, where you have real elections. You know, we've had over a number of decades a building reaction against globalization. The fact that, working people, have standards have, if anything, declined. They see elites and people feel that very much in Michigan. People think, elites have given away the store and globalization and trade agreements and very comfortable, with outsourcing jobs, elsewhere and not worrying or respecting working people. That was a big buildup, for Michigan voters and what they were looking for when they were dealing with Obama. Where was he on NAFTA? Where was he on CEOs and the CEO pay and selling out their companies? And so I think there's very strong resentment, against what's happening with globalization, and resentment that elites and political leaders have sold them out. And so what we have found is that the right has been much more effective in responding to that and consolidating that and appealing to it. It's also filled with a lot of racial resentment and resentment of immigrants. And so if you look at Brexit and the polls getting it wrong in terms of who won. They weren't that far off, but they, were wrong on who, won Brexit. But the country mobilized, to pull out of Europe. But that was all about control over movement of labor. And that was all out of resentment. It was resentment of London and the elites and the media, elite media, not understanding what was happening to the people in their jobs as manufacturing was declining. And, 52% of the British voters voted, for to leave. And so when we do a poll now, we make sure we have 52% who voted to leave. If you don't have that, divide, that big polarization set, that you got 48% who wanted to remain and much more comfortable with engagement in Europe, much more comfortable. There's a big education divide on that. But Boris Johnson, you know, the leaders for Brexit over a number of years have really, energized, mobilized, increased turnout, around it, and drove and moved votes at the end and brought in voters to vote for it. I can do a similar thing, in Israel, and what happened with Netanyahu. But the point is that you're not going to get the polling right unless you have that divide, set. So, right now, nationally, I want 46% to be white, white non-college, voters, same that Trump had in his election. And I also now weight it to Trump's vote. 63% of them voted, for Trump. And I now weight the recall to that in order to make sure that I'm having a poll that I think is, accurate. And so I'm very skeptical when I see any poll now that says whatever it says on whatever issue, because I know when I do my national poll, I have 35% come in as white non-college when it should be 46%, one third low. I mean, people, they're not talking to pollsters. And if you don't factor that in, you're not going to get the reading right.
Right. It's interesting. In those narratives you just described, you could easily take out Boris Johnson and put in Donald Trump.
Absolutely.
Yep. Following the same model that you had seen overseas in these elections.
Although Johnson seems to have more smarts in his little finger than Trump has in his whole body.
Yes, he does. He does. And does have a party around him. Trump is very, very much Trump.
I remember noticing this back in 2016 that Trump was very adept at coming in to Michigan. He did it not just in Macomb County, but all over the state, and really, playing on the grievances of folks. He took, the Democratic message about being concerned, as many of us Democrats are, about the effects of trade on working people in this country, and he just co-opted it. He just took it away, and the voters followed.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Now, the trade agreements were like symbolic of, of America First. Are you standing up for American manufacturing? If you're like part of globalization or NAFTA, and you don't mind that it's rational in a broad sense, to move those workers, to Mexico. As I said, Obama never would have criticized a company for moving its jobs because he thought it made sense within this framework. And Obama was battling for TPP to pass a trade agreement after the election. And Hillary went silent on talking about trade agreements in order not to offend, Obama. And, we just were tongue-tied, in trade, and he just, just used it.
If you were advising Biden, how would you approach this issue, Stan? What would you do?
Well, I mean, look, I listened to his trade advisor, and she says, and she's someone who's been very much part of kind of the establishment on trade issues. But she said, very clearly, how does it affect Build Back Better for the American worker? The starting point is the American worker. How does it affect them? They're not looking for trade agreements. They'll obviously have to do them because of Britain and other places in which they pulled out of Europe. But they're not starting with trade agreements as part of their agenda like Obama has. Trade agreements was like a signature part of the what they were for, and also Bill Clinton. And it's not a signature part of, he starts with how does it build back better? And, he began with, Buy America and an economic plan that, has much more, American procurement. So he's pretty well grounded in America. And once if people believe that, he's viewing things through that filter, I think it makes him quite strong.
This has been fascinating. I appreciate your insights and your willingness to share them with our audience.
Mm. And I'm willing to talk, and I'm willing to answer on almost anything, even when I don't know anything.
At least you sound convincing when you say it.
Well, Stan, you have such a depth of experience. I know it was a big change in your career and your life when you came to us in Macomb County to try to figure out, you know, what famously became the Reagan Democrats.
And well, that's where I learned what, you know, it mattered. And, you know, it's real people, listening to real people. And the, you know, I was an academic at the time. You know, I had just, you know, written some books on South Africa and Israel and Northern Ireland. And I was trying to listen to, you know, workers in all of those places and kind of understand the decisions they were, you know, making. You know, how do they, you know, deal with the fact that, you know, have these, you can use race and the government's going to be with you, you know, and so how does it affect the union leader in terms of what choices he makes? Okay. But I meant listening to them and saying, look, I have to accept they have a legitimate position here. They're coming at this, you know, with, I'm trying to understand, you know, how they're making the choices that are factoring in race. There's racism there, but there's also the labor market is structured, you know, by, you know, the legal racial framework. And these are actually real unionists, trade unionists, you know, what choices they make. So I think that was in my head when I went to Macomb and I listened to voters. And it was at a time, you know, when Jesse Jackson was running, there was a lot of conflict within the Democratic Party. And I was listening to these Macomb voters. And you recall, you know, when I mentioned a quote from RFK, you know, they said, no wonder they shot him. And, you know, a lot of these folks said racist things, a lot of them were no doubt racist. But I was arguing they had reasons why they're working people, and they have reasons why they pulled back from the Democratic Party that go beyond that. And they're still Democrats. You know, they feel like Democrats, you know, have betrayed them. They weren't Republicans, and Democrats had a chance to speak to them. But I wasn't willing to write people off based on what they said. I was that I'm going to listen to them and give voice to what I hear.
Stan, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today. It's great to see you again. Follow your work, your articles very closely, and always a learning experience when we get a chance to talk.
Okay. Well, I will try to come to Macomb as much as I can to try to stay in touch as we go into the future elections.
Great, Stan. Thanks again. Take care.
Thank you. Okay. Take care, too.
That's it for this week. Thanks for listening. And take a moment to tell the world how you feel about our chats on Apple Podcasts.
And if the Republic is still standing in a week, we'll be back.
A Republic, if you can keep it, with Mark Brewer and Jeff Timmer, is a production of Michigan Citizens for a Better Tomorrow.